Welcome. Who signed on?
Hi, Dave. It's Grace from Vendor.
Hi, Grace. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Great. How did you find the first seminar? Was it helpful to you?
Very much so. Yes.
Great. Give me some feedback about the workbook. Is that a useful set of exercises, or what is your experience in using it?
I haven't used the exercises like the brand articulation, brand creation. I thought I would come back to that later.
Okay.
After I learn, you know.
Well, true confession is good for the soul. So, okay. I'll be interested in your feedback, and anyone who is listening to the recording, any feedback you have on the exercises, what's useful, what's not, whatever you have to say, I'm very interested in how productive they are for you. Anyone else signed on?
This is Glenn.
This is Joe. Sorry.
Hi, Glenn. How are you?
Good.
Great. And who else? I didn't quite hear after Glenn.
Joanne in Cincinnati.
Joanne, hi, how are you?
Good.
Well, are there any things that you early birds would like to discuss or talk about before everyone signs on and we go on lecture mode?
I have a question.
I didn't get the recording for the first session there, Dave. Is that sent out or located somewhere?
Yes, it's an MP3 recording that can be downloaded, and I sent out the link to that. It's on the CTA site.
I was able to access it already, so it is
okay.
There.
You might check, Glenn, if you overlooked it in an email. If you don't locate it, send me an email, and I'll respond quickly back to you.
Okay. Yeah, I just signed up tonight. I just signed up.
Okay. Okay. All right. Well, great. I will. I'll get that notice then, and send that out to you. And I'll send a reminder to everyone. But there's the day after, my IT guy at CTA sets up the MP3 download for you to record, and you should have the workbook when you signed up as a download.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Great.
I got that.
Yeah, well, you'll catch up very quickly then.
And I need a note also, Dr. Kruger. This is Joanne.
You need
I did receive an email from you, and I went over everything, and I must have missed the CTA sign-on.
Okay, the playback, the
MP3. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, I'll resend that to everyone tomorrow.
Because last week I missed the last 5 minutes, so I didn't know
okay.
if there was something in that.
Well, I was probably just getting warmed up for those last 5 minutes, so you got to listen to that.
I thought so.
I know. You got to finish strong. Remember we talked about finishing strong? I've got to listen to it to see what happened. But other thoughts or questions or things that you'd like to discuss before we get started? Or clarifications?
It was interesting to read the blog that you sent today.
Ah, yeah.
It was a nice add-on to last week's session. The blog that guy, I forgot his name.
Yeah, Seth Godin, G-O-D-I-N. He is actually, I'll have to confess, his blog is the only one, besides my wife's, that I have sent to my email to read every day. He's had 12 bestsellers in a row. He is a genius at marketing, and he consistently thinks of things in a different way than most people do. And that, I think, was a blend of marketing and really understanding about states of mind. We've read each other's stuff. He actually did a blog a blurb for The Secret Language of Money. So I've been following him for some time, and we've corresponded some. And I'm a real fan of his work, and that blog, I think, would really be worth subscribing to that will give you an idea and just some different ways of thinking about marketing.
Yeah, I agree. I thought I made a hard copy. I saved it, and
okay.
I really did like it. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, great. Thanks. Anyone else? Thoughts, questions, feedback?
Hi, David. Sandy checking in from Omaha.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good.
Great. Anybody else want to raise any questions or address things you'd like us to talk about or discuss now or later? Let's just spend another minute or two with this before we get started with the seminar this evening.
Hi, David. This is Marlene from New York.
Hey, welcome.
And the question that I had, maybe you're going to cover it, is I've heard different opinions on coaches naming their businesses with their own name versus naming their business with something other than their own name. Do you have an opinion on that? Because it all ties into branding.
Well, it does. I think if you look around the corner or a couple of corners and think about expanding your firm to have other services, other products than immediately associated with your name, you might want to think about naming your business something else. Now, if you can't find a name that really sings to you, that you really love, then your name is a good alternate to that. But if you're thinking about having a virtual firm, like where you have coaches who you refer to and get a percentage of that, or services that, well, you know, some executive coaches have a suite of services. They'll have someone they bring in for a 360 or a cultural assessment or a DISC or other things, or even, you know, some people have more extensive services like financial services and people they bring in and refer to and get a percentage of that. So if you're looking at doing anything like that or having a consortium of services, then you might want to think about a name. And if nothing sings to you as a name, your name is great. I would definitely secure your name as a domain name. And here's a kind of a sidebar. Look around the corner, think down the pike about all the things that you're going to do as a coach, all the services, all the products, and secure every domain name that you can think of that will relate to that, because every service or every product needs its own landing page. You've noticed probably that each of my books, you know, the www.newmoneystory is the 5-CD seminar series with a workbook on your new money story. The same for a number of other products. I have probably 20 or 30 URL names secured. It's good insurance. For $14 or $15 for a couple of years, you'll see whether you're going to use it or not. And look at securing that name. So I know that's not the question you asked, but it's something that as you look at developing your practice and your brand, think about everything that's related to it so that you can really develop and expand your brand. You can put all those within the same website and have your IT guy set it up so that it's just a separate landing page, but it's all in your website. So another.
And I agree with that in the sense that I chose a name talking about singing to you when the business name sings to you is right.
Uh-huh.
My company name just it was like an epiphany. And so I don't want to change it, but people in the coaching business, I find a lot of them are using their name. And I'm saying, did I miss something? Because I don't want to use my name because I want to have some privacy left to my life. And I said, you know what? I'm just going to throw that out at you because my company name sings to me. I love it. It connects with people immediately when I say my company name. It just clicks for them, and I got really lucky, I think.
Well, that's great. And you want your name to become known because your name is part of your brand. And privacy is a different kind of boundary than where you are in the public arena of marketing. So thanks for your comments. I'm going to put us on lecture mode and get started. We're going to have a long first period, then break at halftime for questions and comments, and then a shorter second period with discussion following. Welcome back to the Art and Science of Branded Coaching Practice. Let's first talk about values and beliefs. Nathan Handwerker, you know this better be a good story with a name like that. Nathan Handwerker put in a new food stand in 1960 in Coney Island. Handwerker's hot dogs were pure beef, made from his wife's recipe and every bit as delicious as his competitors. But he priced his at 5 cents, and the other hot dogs were priced at 10 cents. He attracted no customers. People wondered if his hot dogs were inferior. They attributed poor quality ingredients to his products. His sales were not increased when he offered free root beer and free pickles. That just furthered the perception that the value must be substandard. Then Handwerker came up with a new ploy. He asked doctors from a nearby hospital to stand around eating his hot dogs while they were wearing their white coats and stethoscopes, and he raised his prices. His hot dogs started selling. People assumed that if he were charging full price and better, and if physicians were eating his food, then it had to be good. They began selling well. They became a national phenomenon. Nathan's famous hot dogs. The value we attribute, the belief, can fundamentally change how we perceive something. Creating a new belief is not an instantaneous thing. It's a process. It can take some period of time. It can occur quickly, or it can take years to complete. The process of changing a belief is just that, a process, not an event. It can be planned, though, step by step, with incremental progress. It takes however long it takes. It's your process, not anyone else's. Don't compare your inside to someone else's outside. Don't compare your journey, your timetable, and your progress with anyone else's. It's uniquely yours, your story. However long it takes, you can make it worth it. In changing your belief, and the result of the change in your action, you're also changing your mind as well as your brain. As we discussed very briefly last time, beliefs are the software that drives behavior. We now know that beliefs can actually turn genes on or turn them off. Remember this equation. Beliefs drive behavior. Behavior drives performance. Look carefully at your beliefs, your assumptions about your coaching business. They are ghostwriting your vision. For example, tell me your assumptions, and I'll tell you how much money you'll make. Let's talk about the monetary value of professional coaching. Some statistics about the monetary value of professional coaching are already in. Three recent business impact studies by the Lohr Institute and one by the Manchester Consulting Group demonstrated an average of six-fold return on investment per dollar spent on professional coaching. That's a $6 return on investment for every dollar spent. Why will clients pay you to talk with them? Here are some things that are not the answer: to get confidence, clarity, meaning. Here are some other things that are not the answer: to get enlightenment, growth, contentment. If you've never had a new client come to you and say, "I want transformation," then you may want to delete it from your hub statement. People don't talk that way because they don't think that way. Of all these reasons that clients do not come, these are epiphenomena. These are results, but they're not reasons. Why will clients pay you to talk with them? To work on issues. They're stuck and can't see the possibilities. They've plateaued and need to break through to another level. They have life or business challenges and need to co-create perspectives and strategies. They may be unclear about their goals. A sidebar here. To distinguish the need for therapy from coaching. If they're broke, they need therapy. If they're stuck, they need coaching. Now, there's a white paper in a bit more elegant language on the distinctions of coaching from therapy accessed on the home page of my website, MentorPath. And the title is Therapy versus Coaching, Fences and Frontiers. So as a coach, get clear about the client's situation and about the value of results, the benefits, in other words. Here are two applications. One, know the situations and issues that clients will hire you for. What are the 5 to 6 things that your ideal client would say that your response could be, that's exactly what I do in coaching? And two, from your perspective, if you were to follow a client around for a day, what would you see that you know that they have a problem or they're stuck? Literally and specifically, what would you see? And where and how could they soar but aren't? Let's talk about energy signatures. Every belief and every behavior have an energy signature attached, positive or negative, attracting or repelling, fostering belief or instilling doubt. Your belief of your value has an energy signature attached. The beliefs and thoughts that have a powerful, positive impact will attract clients. Right now, do this. If you have a pen, jot this down. As it pops into your mind, think of the two most positive, engaging aspects of your coaching practice. Some examples of positive energy signatures. I know the value of my services. I trust my intrinsic value. I have enough. I am prosperous. I know that someone's going to soar if he sticks with me. My ideal clients will hire me, and I'll help them reach their goals. Okay, now also, right now, keep your pen in hand. As it comes to your mind immediately, think of the first two doubts or concerns that you have about your coaching practice. An example of a negative energy signature. Setting fees with an attached scarcity signature. I don't have enough. He probably can't afford my fee. I don't think I have enough experience. I don't have enough credentials. I should charge less so that he or she will hire me. Now, reflect back on your own experience. How you actually felt with each of the two sets of thoughts, the positive engaging and the doubts concerns. That's the same thing your client will experience, one or the other. Create your value. The most important person to convince about your professional value is yourself. When you value your services, others will too. To position yourself as a professional, you need to come across as a professional. Clients hire you when they believe in you to help solve their needs. However, if you come across as uncertain, overly accommodating, subordinate, over-deliver, undercharge, you simply communicate doubt implicitly. For example, in the marketplace, if you don't ask for much money, you're not perceived to have much value. In the marketplace, if you don't have much value, you don't get much money. Funny how it works that way. So, how can you become more valuable in the marketplace? Successful coaches are focused on their clients and the needs of both clients and prospective clients. A key element to focus are the three things that offer the greatest return on your investment: time, money, and training. This means giving up the temptation to be all things to all people. So identify your top three coaching services that you want to focus on. Leave the other areas to other coaches and firms. Fine-tune these three top coaching services to position yourself as an expert. Don't get sidetracked or distracted by all the business opportunities you might be passing up. Some value development questions. And think of these four questions. These are in your outline. What can you help people to understand that without you they wouldn't have? In other words, your unique position. What do you do uniquely well? What is your core message? And again, think of saying this, being able to say this in a very succinct way, in a very short sentence. What's your good news, your aha? Now, here's an example of probably the best value message in history, at least the most productive, the most responded to. I'm going to give you just a few seconds to think what it may be. The value message most productive, most responded to in all of history. Here's the message paraphrased. Y'all know you messed up. Don't worry, it's on me. I got you covered. Do you recognize it? It garners more donations than all other nonprofits combined. It produces the perennial best-selling book. The core message? Salvation. The good news giver? Jesus. Here's an internal memo regarding value application. An internal memo to yourself on three aspects of applying value. One. A clearly articulated value proposition. In other words, the benefits that potential clients and referral sources can readily understand. Two, a rigorous approach to the 80-20 rule. 80% of your revenues and referrals come from 20% of your clients and referral sources. These are the ones who value your skills and services. Regularly review to identify your 20% and focus on expanding your effort with those who have the highest yield. Three, a methodology to separate true prospects from all others. Both your clearly articulated value proposition and identifying true prospects will keep you from chasing unproductive possibilities. How do you shape your delivery system then based on what you want to give people? The answer is based on understanding three things, three simple things. Your value, to do what, and to get where. Perhaps schedule a brainstorming session with yourself, maybe just a brief one, but to answer those questions. Your value, to do what, and to get where. Let's talk about client attraction to value. Here are four tips for attracting new clients even during a slow economy. The economy has nothing to do with it other than as an excuse. Just as someone who says, you know, I really can't afford your coaching services is exactly the person who most needs it. Number one. Ask your potential clients and referral sources what their biggest obstacles or challenges are. Now, this can be done in an email, in person, during a discussion after a presentation you do, or with business associates. Don't assume that you know, but ask. Two, ask also what their biggest desire is. Three, create a service or a program that will address both the obstacle and the desire. Use the most common responses from your question about obstacles and desires to inform how you fashion a solution that other people will pay for. Here's the secret. Obstacles and desires are two sides of the same coin. Obstacles reveal desires. Show me an obstacle, and I'll show you a desire. So instead of figuring out a way to sidestep, overcome, or go around the obstacle, consider instead not creating it and creating what you want with that same energy. When someone is ready to recognize that they create an obstacle, they're ready to consider the possibility of not creating it. And four, take away the risk. It assures potential clients or purchasers to let them know that you guarantee the results and offer their money back. Think of your experience when you purchased a product and you see the guarantee of money back. There are some good stats on this for products from the website. Let's talk about value attribution. On a January morning in 2007, during rush hour, an ordinary-looking guy dressed in jeans and a baseball cap took out his violin in a subway station in Washington, D.C. For the next 43 minutes, he performed one of the most challenging pieces ever composed for the violin, Bach's Sonatas and Partitas for Unaccompanied Violin. 1,097 people walked by. He was barely noticed, just playing on a passenger platform like an average street performer. Actually, only one person of this 1,097 recognized him to stop. His name, Joshua Bell, one of the greatest violinists alive, who regularly performs to sold-out crowds at concert halls throughout the world. His violin, a $3.5 million Stradivarius. I've seen this video of this study by the Washington Post. The D.C. commuters heard a world-class concert, but the value they attributed to Bell's performance was based on their perception. And, astonishingly, I thought, he wasn't even mugged for his violin. Value attribution is our own shortcut to determine how we judge what we see, even to determine if it's worthy of our attention. Then the value we assign shapes our perception, and we cherry-pick data to support that then. Creating your personal value. A few words on altruistic motives about helping others and not getting paid for it. Three words to be precise. Get over it. Now, I'm not speaking of benevolent acts. I'm referring to a belief system masquerading as altruism, a set of limiting assumptions that interfere with the enjoyment, the passion, and the wealth of coaching. When you do pro bono work, make it select and circumscribed in time to protect yourself. So I'm not talking about pro bono work here. Another consideration, I have up to 6 positions for every teleseminar I do that I gift to the executive group of a nonprofit charity. I'm told that the benefits are exponential for the entire organization. If you don't believe your value, your client won't be able to override your veto. Because remember, we're always teaching people how to respond to us. Be clear on the value of your work, the value that you bring clients. Use the language invest. Pay attention to the results the client gets. The key to making money is creating value and doing it consistently. People pay you when you add value to their lives. They reward you with what they feel the value is when you ask. Money is simply a symbol of this value. I was consulted by a multinational company to work with an executive who had gone into a downhill spiral when his supervisory duty to 2 subordinates was transferred to someone else. In the big scheme of things, this was a really minor aspect of his overall function, but it had great impact on him. It was a real personal injury, a kind of narcissistic injury. His behavior was such that they were about to fire him. he was frustrated and about to quit. The only question seemed to be who was going to pull the trigger first. It would have derailed his otherwise stellar executive career. I asked the company how much it would cost them to replace him if he quit. Their estimate, easily $1.5 million. When you do a presentation, a sample session, or initially engage a potential client, rather than thinking about money or having to sell the client on your services, think, how can I add value? Money and value are both perceptions. To illustrate this, and I want to say this again, money and value are both perceptions. And here's an illustration. Volunteers did a taste test of wines, 5 different Cabernet Sauvignon wines. Now, as a footnote here, I follow neuroscience labs all over the world and correspond with some behavioral economics researchers, but I have never been able to find a study like this to volunteer for. Before they tasted, they were told the price of each of the wines. They were then hooked up to brain imaging to see which ones activated their pleasure centers more. The result? They enjoyed the most expensive wine most, and then on down to the least expensive. And the fMRI scans showed the same thing, greater pleasure activation in their brains with the most expensive wine. Now, actually, the volunteers tasted one wine, but with 5 different stories. They experienced more pleasure, and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. How did you say you were going to set your fees, Carl? Now, so figure out how to bring value to others, how to provide them benefits with your service or product, and you'll be rewarded. But remember, you have to ask. You're a professional. And don't mark yourself down by lowering your fee. You're not a clearance sale. In the film Ruthless People, Danny DeVito's character, Sam Stone, said, "A bad salesman will automatically drop his price." If you view coaching as where you get your satisfaction rather than your money, you can set up different ways of serving people where you can earn money. You don't even have to be there. You can even earn it while you're sleeping. If you place wealth as a goal, and if you have a contradictory belief that the pursuit of wealth is materialistic, you have conflict. Wealth will not accrue contrary to a value that opposes it or to ambivalence about it. Ambivalence saps power. Each person decides how to define money. Each person creates a personal definition or lets others hijack the agenda and determine the meaning. An example of money equations. Some people think of money as a reflection of their self-worth. Not really. Money is a reflection of their efficiency. Net worth equals net efficiency. Action gets you money. Efficiency keeps your money. Let's do a break for questions and comments. Can each of you hear me?
Hey, Dave, it's Laura.
Okay, hey, how are you?
Good, how are you?
Great, mastering this technology of getting off of mute.
No,
I
see you're struggling with technology a little bit.
Yeah, I've been called technologically challenged, but that's another issue. Go ahead.
Always great to hear your lilting voice and your last statements about efficiency and keeping money. I was just wondering if you could just talk a little bit more about
Well, you know, the one thing that you're probably familiar with, one survey that I did when an earlier book on money came out was to ask several hundred people totally to fill out a card that I provided and would be treated anonymously and confidentially. One was, there were three numbers on it. The first question was, what is your current annual income? Secondly, what would your current annual income need to be in order to have no money worries and be completely happy about your money? And third, what does money mean to you? Now, the first two questions, over 90% of people indicated that they would need to make about twice as much money as they made now to be comfortable, carefree, and happy about their money. This was true for people who made $50,000 a year who thought they needed to make $100,000, to people who made $500,000 and thought they needed to make $1,000,000. And in follow-up, people who had doubled their income when they made $100,000 thought it would take $200,000. Now that they made $200,000, they thought it would take $400,000 to be happy and worry-free about money. So that raises the question of how much is enough and of having specific goals rather than more, because more and perfect aren't goals. The third question is all the different signifiers and emblems of money, all the different personal meanings that we attach to money, from worth and love to freedom, you know, any number of meanings that we all have. So the things that we attribute to money, and there are social conventions that emphasize several, like self-worth and that sort of thing, because net worth and self-worth get to be amalgamated at times, to distinguish what meanings we attach to money, actually to also look at the kind of efficiency that we have, that money and worth is a reflection of our efficiency. I guess the simplest way is that my dad kept telling me as I was growing up, you know, it's not what you make, it's what you keep. So that's a one form of efficiency, you know, the net result, when money's only money. And you know, as we've discussed in other settings, money is a Rorschach. It's something we project ourselves and our intentions, what we like, what we don't like about ourselves on the money. So we see it as all kind of things. But when you look at it in a very simple way, money is simply money. It's a unit of exchange for goods and services. So I think that's useful for us as coaches to think about and to keep in mind in working with clients to help them look at or sort out any things that they have going on, any goofiness or mishigas they have about money that keeps them from seeing things very clearly. And, you know, and the reason that I put this series of seminars together are the questions that a number of coaches that I've trained and consulted with and mentored have as struggles, because they have difficulty getting and collecting their fees. They have difficulty in looking at how do they present themselves. So these four seminars are the direct result of a number of questions, just as what you ask, that is my hope and attempt to elaborate some ways of thinking about these things to make them clearer for us so that we can then in turn make them clearer for our clients. And remember Thomas Leonard, the guy who started all this in coaching, said, you know, after all, we just need to be one step ahead of our clients. So this is my attempt to keep us all one step ahead of our clients. Now, Laura, did that really answer your question specifically?
No, Dave.
I don't want to waste
class time, but if you have a chance to email me, what I need you to explain to me is your idea of efficiency here. I don't understand the relationship. I need you to come up with a better definition for efficiency as it relates to money. I don't know if you're referring to people getting clearer about their money issues. I don't get it. So please don't waste the time of the class, you know, unless other people have questions.
Okay, if I can come up with anything, I'll mail it out to everybody.
Okay, that's okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah, thank you.
Okay.
Hey, Dave, this is Allison in Minneapolis.
Hey, welcome.
Hi. I have a question. You were talking, I think, about a delivery system, and you talked about the value to do what to get where, and I kind of lost where you were going with that. Who is filling in the blanks there, the coach or the client, and can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, and that's a good clarification. The thinking about how you're going to deliver your services is what I was referring to. When you think about your services, and if that's coaching services, if it's more, if it's products, so your delivery of those services or products will be based on what you want to give people. And these are three questions to ask yourself to be really clear, as I obviously wasn't, to be really clear about what you want to address in terms of how you're shaping that, how you're presenting it. What is your value? To be really clear about what your value is. You may not put that into a statement. It's kind of like brand. This is for internal use, but you want to be really clear about what your value is. What is your unique proposition, your unique position that you do better than anyone else? What is your value to do what and to get where? You know, how can you help someone do something to get to someplace new in a way that you can articulate in a very simple, clear, precise way? So these are questions to ask of yourself to be sure that you find a way of addressing them in some of your message. Does that help?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. Maybe one more question or comment?
Hey, Dave?
Yes.
This is Glenn. You mentioned about indifference to money. For years, you know, having the desire to attain money, I finally got in a position where I trained myself to not be concerned about money because it was coming in. As time went on, I kind of praised myself for doing all those affirmations and getting to the position of being indifferent to money. Now that I have no income, I'm wondering that you mentioned that, whether this indifference to money is a major problem in attracting money.
Okay, I'm glad you clarified that or highlighted that. Do a star six if you want to come back and comment. Tell the dog I'll try to handle this one by myself. I want to clarify that I'm not speaking about indifference to money. I'm speaking about addressing issues that have to do with money, addressing all the business aspects of coaching, taking care of the business aspects, including setting and addressing professional fees, and we'll talk about that next seminar, so that it's a background issue. To take care of it totally and to address all the things that you need to, you don't have to keep giving it constant attention. And you sort out your own money issues so that you have the respect and it has the place that you need it to be. Then, when if a client has money issues, you'll be able to see that clearly and help the client address those issues clearly. And, you know, think about how that's going to manifest. If a client has money issues or difficulty paying their bills, the process is going to be recreated with you. They're going to have an issue with money with you. If they have difficulty with paperwork, they're going to have difficulty with paperwork with you. So whatever is going on in the process of coaching is not something to get beyond and get back to the coaching. This is what coaching is dealing with the process as it manifests in the relationship with you. As it comes alive, you'll see the evidence of it, and you'll see the evidence of the beliefs and the assumptions as they get lived out with you. And this is the basis of the power of coaching. When you have that working alliance established, when you can get away with challenging, with story busting, with acting like a Dutch uncle, with doing the kind of things with a client that they need to do that nobody else in the world dares do with them. You're working with a CEO. Do you think anybody in that person's company will dare to challenge him or her or do the kind of things that need to be done about looking at some goofiness in human dynamics or something he's doing that's off-putting? But you can. And the challenge is he or she's going to start doing it with you too. So So that allows you to really have the power of the in vivo experience. It comes alive, and you get the opportunity to deal with it. So it's not an indifference, but it's an attention to an issue so that it can be background issue. Unless a client brings it to the foreground, then you know clearly what's coming from the client and what's coming from you. Does that help, Glenn?
Yeah, because certainly. Putting it in the coaching context, and it's actually the awareness and addressing the issues. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, let me go back on lecture mode, and there's some other things I want to share with you, and then we'll talk again. Let's talk about the idea of a good idea versus a goal. I think it's important, as you know as coaches, to establish goals for yourself, goals for your business, specifically for your income. So anything but indifference here. Have a business plan. It's the blueprint for your business. An outline of a business plan is in your seminar outline. I think a business plan is as important for your business as a blueprint is for an architect or a book outline for writing a book. It's estimated that less than 10% of people have measurable goals. 100% of people have good ideas, at least some. The difference between a good idea and a goal, measurement and time. The travel agent questions, where and when, where do you want to go, when do you want to arrive? Here's a good idea, I'd like to lose weight. Here's a goal, I will reach 185 pounds by 5 p.m. December 31st. Here's a good idea. I want to make more money. Here's a goal. I will generate $220,000 from coaching and $315,000 from products and royalties in the next 11 months. There's an exercise on strategic goal pursuit in your outline in the workbook. Also, write a breakthrough goal, something that will stretch you, bring incredible opportunities, and move you to a higher level, a quantum leap. Getting a book on the New York Times bestseller list. Spending every March skiing in Steamboat Springs and every August riding on the coast of Maine. Now, you'll have to substitute your own goals here. Then, reread your goals, regular and breakthrough, twice a day, when you wake up and when you go to bed. What exactly are you afraid of? You didn't have a book on the New York Times bestseller list before you sent your manuscript to an agent. If you get rejected, you still don't. So what do you got to lose? What's the problem? You spent your whole life not having a New York Times bestseller. So take a chance. A young chiropractor just out of professional school wanted to open a practice in Carmel, California. He was told that he would never make it. There's already one chiropractor for every 8 people in Carmel. He went to 12,500 homes and talked to 6,500 people. He asked 3 questions. Which location should I open my office, the north or west side of town? Should I have extra office hours from 7 to 9 in the morning or from 5 to 7 in the evening? And which newspaper should I advertise in? He added, when I have an open house party, would you like an invitation? He took in $72,500 the first month and netted over $1 million his first year. Visualization and the law of attraction. Visualization is a way to rehearse for your future. You program a future memory. Visualization brings about actual physical change in the brain. The brain can't tell the difference between a mental image and an actual image. The same activation occurs in the brain. Visualization brings about real changes in your brain. Visualization of complex movements can even improve performance. And we know that by simply picturing a danger, we can trigger the entire body responses of fight and flight. The law of attraction, as well as neuroscience, tells us that we bring about what we focus on, not what we want. You are always achieving your vision. It's useful, necessary even, to know precisely what that vision is, and if it's the one you need and want it to be. Visualization now does not always involve seeing an image or a mental picture, especially if you're not a visual person. It's not necessary to see a mental image. You may sense it or feel it, or you may imagine how it sounds, or it may be a set of thoughts and ideas, the entire experience of the success. So in other words, it depends on whether you're primarily a visual or an auditory or a kinesthetic learner or processor. So don't overvalue the idea of a picture if you're not a picture person. When you expect and imagine limitations, you create them. To create something different must be structured, given attention initially and then repeated until you achieve it. When benefits and assumptions include problems or obstacles, these get incorporated into the vision you live out. You're always putting forth a vision of what you expect to happen and living it. Put forth a clear request to yourself of what you really want, consciously shaped and realistic of your specific goals. Here's the key to visualization. You do not make a brain change permanent unless you incorporate it into your own story. Otherwise, it doesn't register or gets extruded as noise. You can't relegate it to a footnote. This may be why, for example, 95% of people who diet gain back their weight. They don't reprogram their body image. For example, as you see yourself in a successful business, you create this specific imagery to live that experience. You then incorporate it as part of your identity. Your unconscious mind can't tell the difference between something you physically see and something you mentally picture, as I just mentioned. But your conscious mind can. And your conscious mind must incorporate an evolving story to include and assemble the imagery as part of the story. Otherwise, the unconscious message will delete access or believability of the images. There are three key elements. One, specificity. Be very specific about the experience of achieving the goal of success of your coaching business. Not about getting there, but about being there. Two, repetition. The neural networks dedicated to your vision have to be renewed and repeated regularly, or they'll be eliminated. Three, program new identity. Consciously incorporate this new vision into an ongoing story to ultimately be metabolized as part of your true self. Otherwise, you'll lose the vision. A chapter from Outsmart Your Brain, an instruction manual that's on the old art and new science of visualization is in the addendum to the workbook. It includes a section on the art and science of affirmations. Affirmations reprogram mind software. Visualizations rewire brain hardware. And here's a margin note. Write it down for review. Research on memory tells us that a new idea or fact lasts an average of 40 seconds in short-term memory. Then it's gone, unless it's emotionally significant or unless you work to log it in. Here's an illustration of visualization. Basketball players at Ohio State University were divided into three groups to practice shooting free throws. One group, no practice for 1 month. The second group, 30 minutes of practice daily at free throws. The third group practiced imagining shooting perfect free throws, nothing but net, for at least 5 minutes daily for 30 days. They were tested at the end of 30 days. The first group, no practice, 0% improvement. Second group, actual practice for 30 minutes daily, 24% improvement. Third group, practice by visualization only, 23% improvement. On brain imaging, the same sequence of firing occurs with visualization as when actually shooting. If you do not have a purpose for each dollar that you have or will have, you may not have it. A goal enhances motivation. A strategy enhances focus. deadlines can crystallize the work to complete the requirements for the deadline. And maybe if you didn't have the deadline, the work would have dragged out. Economics and wealth work the same way. If you do not have clear, visualized goals of how you will earn, manage, and ultimately use each dollar, the dollar may not manifest. Some final comments I want to make on value and gender, and specifically overcoming mental barriers to equal fees. In recent studies, specifically a recent article in the Harvard Business Review, Mary Davis Holt reviewed her work with several hundred women executives to focus on their income. She found that in some instances, women had to overcome organizational barriers to get equal pay as men. They had to ask for what they wanted and deserved. Holt emphasizes the need for many women to look at internal barriers that are at least as common as the external ones. In order for a woman to get to the top, she may have to overcome some of her own deep-seated assumptions and behaviors that may interfere, like settling for a helper role in a major deal, or not taking the lead to initiate new business. Now, this is not about a woman relinquishing her values, but unlearning certain notions that can actually masquerade as values. For example, if deep down you believe that self-promotion, competition, and a winning strategy are unbecoming to a woman, or are anathema to who you are, this may need examination. These beliefs and behaviors may be coupled with being incensed by a failure to get a raise or shocked by an evaluation that accurately reflects this behavior. Consider also something that I have seen consistently and have written about. A girl is raised in a traditional family in which the ideal of a female is loving, giving, nurturing to others, to the exclusion at times of her own needs. To succeed at living up to this ideal would result in a failure in her own growth. On the other hand, to succeed, she would have to fail at living up to this ideal. And the result there is shame. Shame is the feeling that results from not living up to one's own ideal. In coaching, this self-concept is part of the software revision that may come with establishing goals and strategies and successfully living into them, and the accompanying change in self-concept as these changes get programmed into a new identity for your client. In fact, a number of years ago, I did a study with a colleague from my book, The Last Taboo, Money, a Symbol, and Reality. What we found was that women therapists charge significantly less than men therapists with similar education, years of experience, and geographic location. One other thing that Holt found was how much a worker loses over a career by not negotiating a higher salary at the beginning, even slightly higher. Surveys suggest that an overwhelming majority of men ask for higher salaries and often get them, but only a small fraction of women challenge an initial offer. Consider this for your initial professional fees you set in coaching. So, in summary then, study the available resources, consult an advisor or mentor, define what you want and hone your presentation or statement to get what you deserve. This is the kind of negotiating business executives do every day. Mary Davis Holt concludes by saying this. This is a quote. The ability to earn what you're worth arises from a set of skills that will improve with diligent effort by any woman who sets out to master them. And I will add, by any man as well. There are a couple of exercises in the addendum at the end of your outline that will apply to this seminar. I've mentioned them, strategic goal pursuit and 11 steps to ignite change. I'd specifically recommend that you work yourself on these exercises and see if they may be of benefit to use with your clients. Okay, thoughts, questions?
So, Dave?
Yes.
Okay, two things, two comments, and I'll get out of the way. One about the issue of women charging significantly less than men, and I'm curious if there's any research that talks about what women actually are willing to pay. I mean, this is kind of a very personal thing, but a lot of women I know, coming from their relatively, from another perspective, undervalued of whatever, who are not making as much money, will not tend to pay the kind of money that men who have a greater seemingly sense of value and charge more. So they don't show up necessarily in the doorstep of people who charge that much. And the other comment I want to make is that regarding what we get, like going back to the previous conversation that I think his name is Glenn, I hope, mentioned about on the issue of money, or, you know, and we were just talking a little bit, sometimes we tend to get what we're working on, so that when somebody is coming to you, you're being challenged with their stuff, it's because you're challenged with that stuff, and you're drawing directly at your own level of growth. And I will just point it out with a very brief story about being a massage therapist for many, many years. And within the first 5 years, I did a lot of hotel work, and I had a concern within those first few years of being propositioned all the time. I was going to top-rated hotels, but I was still anxious because the vast majority of my clients were men. And as long as it took me to learn I could handle the situation, shall we say, when it came up, as long as they,
you know, fellow massage therapist here,
as long as it took me to master that, was at the moment that I understood I was in control, that I could handle it in a peaceful, non-polarized fashion, I no longer was propositioned in any way, shape, or form, or on the rare occasion that it happened, it was a non-event. But I use that as an example, because when we're talking about this issue of coming into value as people who do coaching and setting value, this is going to be an issue that will come up a lot, and if we don't take responsibility, these people are really reflecting what we are inside.
Exactly. I think you have really two excellent points. I think you're very right about the kind of people who are attracted, and money attracts money, and if someone has an issue, they may not want to spend more. This study that we did also had a control variable of men versus women patients to address that, but I think you're very right in most instances. Let me underscore, we are out of time, but if you'll hang with me for just about 45 more seconds, I want to emphasize the issue that Laura mentions. I had the experience as an analyst, the same experience I have now in the last several years as an executive mentor coach. And the issue in analysis that I first became aware of is that when I had other professionals in analysis with me, other therapists, for example, other psychiatrists, psychologists, analysts, when they successfully dealt with an issue that they finally came to some understanding and resolution on, they were astonished to note that about 7 or 8 of their patients suddenly were presenting those issues to them. And it was as if their patients were patiently and unconsciously taking a number, waiting until it was a time that their therapist or analyst could deal with this. And then they presented it, knowing somehow in that subterranean energy transfer that could happen. Same thing with coaches. You will notice your clients are dealing with issues that you have just successfully dealt with. This is why it's so important to deal with all of these aspects and to get comfortable with money, with setting and collecting professional fees, so that you can help your client do the same. And this is exactly where we'll pick up next time, and there's some other aspects of this that we'll talk about in the session next time about fees. Thank you all very much. Thanks for your energy and input. I value that very much. If there are questions or comments that we didn't get to talk about or ran out of time, email me, and I'll try to work it into the discussion at the beginning of next time. Thank you all very much. Same week next
time. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you, Dave.
Oh.